Hi, and Roy, thanks for joining me in our conversation today. I'm so excited to be able to talk with you.
I'm excited to be here.
So just to set a little context, Roy, we've been friends for several years now, and we've always, you know, had this relationship where we've been able to have these, you know, pretty powerful conversations with each other. And I asked you to join me because a few weeks ago, you were sharing a story with me about a student that was trying to get into your program. And I wanted to really just kind of revisit that story and revisit that story through our Compassionate Dialogue or RIR protocol. And so I just am so grateful that you agreed to join me.
Well, literally anything for you. Anything. So my name is Roy Leitner, and I'm an assistant professor at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and specifically the musical theater program. And to start the story off, we do national auditions. So I probably view roughly about 1,000 auditions around the country for multiple, like either they come to the institution or they've sent in videos or I go to conferences. And I attended the, what they call the Unified Theater Auditions for college, the college theater programs in Chicago. And there's probably roughly about 40-ish musical theater programs that attend. And this, to get into a musical theater program is pretty competitive. There's, we're looking for anywhere from 10 to 14 students, possibly 16. As well as like all of these other programs that are sort of more conservatory type based programs, but in a liberal arts education. So it keeps the numbers really down. So I went to Chicago for the Chicago Unified Auditions, and I met in Chicago at one of the auditions, a non-binary student that was just fantastic. In terms of talent, maybe like a little raw, but I just felt a connection with this person. And come to find out, they were there only because of this program called the College Audition Fund, which seeks out and serves underserved minority groups and helps provide financial resources for them to actually make all these auditions, which proved to be quite expensive with like flights, coachings, you know, practicing your music, accompanist, like all of these sorts of things, hotel rooms. I mean, to go to one school and audition, you have to have a flight, a hotel room
right,
for multiple days. So I met this incredible non-binary student, and I sort of just fell for their spirit and their innate ability to sort of manipulate between characters. And I wanted them to be part of our program so much. And due to their financial situation, they were having a hard time trying to figure out how to make ends meet in order to be part of the program, especially as an out-of-state student.
Right.
And being part of this college audition fund, I ended up being in contact with the director of that program. Their current situation is their father is engaged, but also has multiple children, and is a single parent. So he at the time really sort of couldn't commit a lot of energy to trying to figure out how to navigate to get the student to university. So ended up having a conversation with the head of this college audition fund program on possible ways that we could get the student to the university. And because the student, after the FAFSA, the expected contribution of the family was zero, which makes things really challenging for an out-of-state student. And I was like, I wasn't done. I felt like there was more that I could do. So I ended up starting writing letters on their behalf to our admissions program, our financial aid program, also starting to try and figure out different ways or grants or things that we could apply for.
You recognize that there was an issue. You recognize that the student has one potential but doesn't have the resources. Yeah. And what you decided to do was to interrupt kind of what I think is chronic. You know, how many of our best and brightest are left behind because they can't access the system, you know, whether it's financially or whatever the barriers are, and then they just fall off, you know, without anyone being able to advocate. So your interruption of that is to actually step in and start advocating on their behalf to figure out how to get them into the program. So what I want to do real quick though is when you, the recognized part, what was coming up for you when this was happening, when you realized that the student wasn't going to be able to attend because of the, what feelings came up for you in this process?
Frustration, mm-hmm. anger. I got really mad at the systems that were in place that didn't seem to serve what I thought they should be serving.
Yeah.
I also sort of had this feeling of like, I don't know enough at this moment to answer these very specific questions that I was even asking of, you know, being a state institution. So there was definitely a point of like frustration, anger, not at the student, but also like I felt helpless. Like I felt like there wasn't anything I could do, which I don't take very well. So that's when I started really trying to figure out what, if there was anything possible that I could do. And I realized I needed to start talking to the folks in financial aid specifically. So those were the feelings first, is like frustration, anger at the situation. Mm-hmm. Also like a little like dumbfounded, like here's a student who doesn't meet the criteria in terms of like the academic scholarships that they can achieve from the institution, but they innately have something else to offer. Like,
right. And so it calls into question how limiting our criteria are, right? When we think about what we decide is worth scholarship, what we decide and who we decide is worth, you know, providing those types of supports for. And if they don't fit into this kind of picture or this identity that we've identified, then again, they're left behind.
Exactly. And as an arts program in a state institution, we have merit-based scholarship, which I was able to offer a large amount for us to offer to the student, but that actually, in the grand scheme of looking for like out-of-state tuition, doesn't necessarily help, because most of the money or the bigger monies comes from academics. Mm-hmm. And that's literally like, is what score do you have and what's your GPA and like where do you fall in?
Right.
And that was just so frustrating for me, even working inside the system, the institution. Mm-hmm. And they have programs at the school, at the university, but they're for in-state students.
Yeah.
They're not for out-of-state students.
Yeah. Yeah, so what happens when you, where everything about who you are is outside of where the support is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like I said, I just started trying to I had to learn first, and you know, I'm still learning. Don't think I like got it all, because that's a whole world that I'm learning about. And a lot of times professors just pass that off to admissions and mm-hmm. the scholarship. I mean, there's whole offices for this, but I was trying to advocate and campaign for one very specific student.
Right.
So ran it. Basically what happened is I just kept running into like roadblock trying to like figure out all of these things. I mean, I even at one point was researching like if they, the word is not emancipated, removed themselves from their family and claimed independence.
Yeah, that's emancipation.
Oh, work. I got it. emancipated themselves from their family. Mm-hmm. Would that change how like the federal government structures look at like through the FAFSA, and the answer is no. Okay. Because still family contribution is zero,
right,
in this specific case.
Right.
So then the other thing that I was looking at was like, well, what if they move to Alabama, mm-hmm, and then claim in-state tuition, but you have to have been residing in Alabama for a certain amount of time before, right, you can claim
in-state. So can I ask you why so much energy?
They deserve it.
Like, yeah.
They just deserve it. Everything. I was captivated. Their spirit is, knowing like their background from the little bit I know, and their spirit, and having sort of these exchanges with the student, and knowing they were really interested in being part of our program. Like, that's where they wanted to go. It was like their top choice. Mm-hmm. The energy was worth it. Like, I felt like they needed someone else to advocate and fight for them.
Yeah.
And I wish that there is a happy ending to, mm-hmm, the story, but there's not. So what ended up happening was, I sat down with my colleagues and explained the whole situation. And so we can't admit them into the university. We can only admit them into the program. And they were admitted into the university. But basically just formed an official letter that said, you have admittance into our program for the next 2 more years. You don't have to re-audition. We would love to have you.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I put in the letter, and I mean this very, like, the world needs what they have to give.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how it sort of ended. And I know that their story is that they're currently at a community college in their state. Mm-hmm. They were actually not able to even make it into
a 4-year.
Any sort of 4-year program for musical theater.
Yeah.
Which is so disheartening to me. So part of me feels like I need to even learn more to understand how I could better serve in the next situation, or find the loophole, or...
Yeah, I mean, because the third piece of the protocol is repair, right? And so repair isn't always... I mean, we try to repair with the individual, but there... you're really limited to what you can do. But what you can do is figure out how to repair the system, right? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean you're, again, the repair doesn't guarantee success, but the fact that you're still thinking of, like, what happens next time? How am I better prepared? How do I continue to educate myself, right? And maybe it comes up that you have an opportunity to repair the system so that these exceptions become there's a pathway for them. There's a way for them to do that where, you know, we start to look at things differently. And I think that COVID is actually offering us an opportunity. I know that there's been a lot of talk around universities about, you know, teaching not only out of state, but teaching out of the country and opening up those doors. And so, you know, what would it look like if there was no longer kind of in-state and out-of-state tuition differences between students being able to access the curriculum? Because right now, no one can show up on campus anyway, right? So yeah. We've got to figure something out. So I think that I'm encouraged by the fact that you're still super engaged in trying to figure it out on the personal level, but also on the systemic level, and that's all part of following it through.
And I think that's also one of the things that really sort of interests me is I feel like a lot of these programs are established for in-state students, mm-hmm, where would have been the answer to the problem, but there's nothing sort of established for out-of-state students, mm-hmm, especially that I'm aware of at state universities.
Yeah. You know, it's got me thinking, and my mind just is going a little bit off, but I start thinking about, you know, is there a possibility of creating, you know, scholarship funds that are for those, you know, for those kind of high risk, at risk, marginalized populations of students, you know, into this program. You know, there's lots of arts funds that are around. You know, what would it look like to think about creating something that that could have supported this student, you know, in pursuing their dream to be a part of this program? Especially because I think, I would imagine, because I recall, and you didn't mention it, but I recall you saying just that there was some issue with them being non-binary that was also interfering with the kind of the support they were getting.
Yeah, that, it felt like there was a lot of education around non-binary going on in my conversations with some multiple different people. Yeah. I think that sort of support didn't even really exist in the home life as well.
Right.
Which I think made it even more challenging to kind of navigate these situations. Yeah, it's, you know, and then that also leads to is how much in the world of musical theater is anyone writing for a non-binary character? Right. And the answer is not often, yeah. Right? And so it brings up a whole bunch of other systemic issues that are entrenched at the moment in any sort of theatrical education, you know, because most of the conversations you get it, how many students are you taking? And then you say your number. So I'll say 12. And they'll say, how many boys, how many girls? Mm-hmm. And I say people. I'm looking for 12 people.
Right.
And
right.
Then like, no, like that's also sort of like a shift in the mindset. So like that's why I think we even had some other non-binary students audition for us, but this specific human, I just they're great.
Yeah.
They're just great.
Yeah, you know, I think that is like the micro of the macro, right? When you think about it, one thing that what you just shared brought up for me was, you know, well, I did a podcast, listened to one with Isabel Wilkerson, who wrote The Warmth of Other Suns, but she just wrote another book called Caste, C-A-S-T-E. But okay. She makes this analogy with the caste system and actually casting, C-A-S-T, right? And how we have roles and who fits into those roles. And so, you know, what does a leading man, right, look like? And
right.
And that's not just, you know, non-binary is so far off, right? Because we can't even deal with race yet. You know, right. If you're Asian, you know, you're, you know, typecast. Is that what it's called, typecast?
Yeah. I mean, you say typecast, stunt cast, you could use all the terms. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, you're just very limited into what you can do, you know, depending on your race and depending on your, you know, your accent and depending on all this and really, you know, starting to kind of start to turn that upside down. You know, it's time. It's seriously time.
Yeah. And it's happening. I think that's one of the, like, if there are great things that are coming out of this pandemic, mm-hmm. it's given the excuse of time mm-hmm. is no longer an excuse or people can lean on it as hard. And and also because of everything that's happened with the Black Lives Matter movement, the theater world itself actually has BIPOC groups have come together and have started calling in theatrical education departments into things that occurred to them of very, very sort of racist statements mm-hmm. and making people trying to acknowledge their own racial bias.
Right.
As well as within the theatrical industry, there's like there's a movement called the We See You movement that's actually has put forth a list of demands to the professional industry about how to be more create more equitable spaces for BIPOC individuals.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, you know, I mean, I think that we have to kind of go through those difficult moments in order to change. Like nothing's going to change without some discomfort and conflict. And so I think we're in this moment where we can really start to demand to see some of those things happen. And it's long overdue. And I think now it's just become, like, I've known it's long overdue, you know, you've known, but now it's becoming more common knowledge that, you know, it's time for us to start having these conversations and looking at all the things that, you know, we take from the theater, things we take for granted, and we just assume this is the way it is. And it's time for a redefinition.
Yeah, and it exactly. And also it's time for white individuals like myself to really dive even deeper into the definitions, or what are these definitions, and not that I'm asking every human in the world to agree on a definition, but I need to understand what your definition is, so I know what you're saying to me.
Right.
And I think we have, like, there's a lot of, there's just a call to action that has to be met.
Yeah, absolutely. Roy, thank you so much for your time. I always love talking with you, but I'm so excited about the possibilities of what can come out of this if we take advantage of what we're given right now.
Yeah.
And thank you for sharing your story with me, because I remember the first time you told me, it was because I was right, you were right in the middle of it. You were trying to figure all this stuff out.
Yes.
And I was like, this is the protocol. Like, this is compassionate dialogue. And we call it dialogue, and I almost feel like it's a misnomer, because it's not just about the conversations we have, but it's also about the actions we take, like what we're willing to do for another human being to support them, even if we don't necessarily understand it completely ourselves. I don't have to be fully knowledgeable on something. I just have to feel and have empathy for someone else's circumstance and be willing to take action.
Yeah, and follow through.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a repair. It doesn't, without the repair, it's just an interruption. So thank you so much.
You're the best. It's so good to see you.
You're the best. It's good to see you too.
Visit www.epiceducation.com for resources that will help you to understand and navigate the ever-changing world of diversity, equity, and inclusion. We are a company that trains and transforms with innovative in-person and online equity workshops that support school districts and leaders to build capacity to carry on this work internally. Now go out and have an epic day.